session number 10112, reel 3.
Mr. Thompson, reel 3.
But nothing particularly vile or vicious. Now, if I could go back a bit. Throughout all 1948 and 1949, the chiefs and headmen were becoming increasingly uneasy about these activities. Mambo Mabai, as we used to call them, doing bad things. All sorts of odd news started to filter out of Nairobi into the districts, including the first references to a secret oath. And also, the Kikuyu Independent Schools Association, which won the same thing as the Kikuyu Central Association, at that same time decided not to cooperate with the Education Authority. They were going out on a limb to do their own thing. And in 1949, a lot of young men between the age of circumcision and marriage began to swagger about in a kind of uniform. Rather hard to put your finger on what the uniform was. It was the way they wore their hat or the colour of their shirt. For a time, young men coming out of Nairobi all wore a black shirt and a trilby hat. They began to behave offensively to their elders, their clan and family elders. Stroppiness, a sort of teenage stroppiness. Now, we learnt at this time that they were being put up to this in Nairobi, where the Kikuyu Central Association could hide itself in the back blocks of the city. And they started to come out and stir things up. And I think it was they sort of were aiming at an ultra-enclosed society. Now, I don't think these young people themselves, which included young girls, would have thought that way, but I'm sure that their political bosses were aiming for this. They wanted the Kikuyu to become ultra-secret again, so that the white man would know nothing about what they were up to. And this is the basis of oathing. They were helped in Nairobi about this time by the High Commissioner for India, whose name was Mr. Appah Pant, who made it abundantly clear that he could assist subversion in many ways, especially with money. He said in several public speeches that he had a brief to instruct all Indian citizens, or citizens of Indian extraction, to be passive in their attitude towards the colonial government and its officers, and to assist those who fight for freedom. This is the first time we really got into this jargon of fighting for freedom. I met Mr. Appah Pant on several occasions. I think in a strange way he was a very well-meaning man. He firmly believed that the time had come for the African to break out and fight for freedom. But it didn't help us in dealing with this increasing subversiveness which was going on. I mean, we had our worries about this, but we also had to keep the daily round of administration going. You can't stop administering. People have still got to be persuaded to improve their lives. In one sense, we spoke for the government. Another sense, we spoke for the local council, the local native council. And I suppose we spoke for ourselves, really. We weren't colonialists. We didn't recognise the word. We felt that we were doing the best for the people in the district. And one of the ways we could do our best was to stop this naughtiness, this stroppiness, this increasing bloody-mindedness of these people who are coming in from Nairobi and they're being assisted by the Kikuyu Central Association on the ground. I suppose in one sense we weren't helped by the settlers, the white settlers. We had nothing to do with them. We were the African administration. But we were conscious all the while of the fact that the settlers' minds were closed. that they knew nothing of what was going on in African areas. They knew nothing of the development was taking place, the development of African district councils. And we didn't get any support from them. And because the white settlers were dominant in the legislature, and the government, therefore, on the ground in Nairobi, we found it difficult, I think, in our reports to persuade people in Nairobi that anything really was happening. We had a very good governor at the time, Sir Philip Mitchell. Now, Sir Philip Mitchell was, I don't want to demean the man because he was an excellent governor. I don't want to demean him because he was an excellent governor. But it was felt that he was very much a settler's man. They had his ear. I don't think he appeared enough in the African areas. I remember he came to Fort Hall on one occasion and stayed in, as it were, the governor's train down on the local sidings. I don't think he found it awfully easy to mix with Africans. He certainly didn't put himself across to them as Sir Evelyn Baring, his successor, did. But as things became more difficult, we had to spend a lot of our time, we administrative officers, spend of our time trying to assuage the growing fears of the majority of the Kikuyu, who were coming under pressure, especially government servants. I mean, here in Britain we lock our doors at night. Imagine what it's like if you live in a grass hut on a dark hillside, miles from anywhere, and someone comes along and threatens you with a machete. You're going to do whatever it is they demand. Well, the first demands were for money for the growing political organisation. Then, as people began to report that money was being extorted from them, the next thing was to enforce an oath of secrecy upon them. And this, in a way, became the first Mau Mau oath. The oath, by the end of 1949, oathing was widespread, and we knew that many people were being killed for refusing to take it. At the end of the emergency in Fort Hall alone, we dug up over 250 parcels, sacks of bones, of skeletons, of people who had been killed for not taking the oath and who had just been stuffed down in ant bear holes.
Whereabouts were they dug up?
Oh, all over the place. All over the place. There wasn't a part of Fort Hall where you couldn't dig up people who had been murdered by Mau Mau.
So they were in individual parcels rather than in a mass grave?
Oh, yes, yes. Mass graves. Actually, Mau Mau didn't bother to, if they murdered anyone, other than these secret oathing ceremonies, I mean, they never bothered to dig graves. They'd leave the corpses about in general. But, of course, all this oathing was illegal. It was contrary to law. And by virtue of its secrecy, strange enough, it was contrary to tribal law, because oaths in Kikuyu tribal custom had to be taken publicly. And that, in a way, was its eventual undoing. More of that later. But fear of death alone made this secret oathing at night acceptable. Now, it was widely believed by the Kikuyu that Kenyatta had taken the first of these oaths, and that the original oathing teams, which went round, were sent out by him. Now, whether that's true or not doesn't matter. It's what the people believe is what matters, and that is what they believed. And whatever the truth, Kenyatta's failure to condemn this oathing, or the oathing teams, acted as a sort of form of blessing on his part. Now, an oathing team usually consisted of a man who was known as the administrator, an assistant, a clerk to record the names and addresses of people who had taken the oath. They wanted their own records. Later we were to capture those records, it was a great help. Four askari, as they call them, thugs if you like, equipped with whips and machetes, and a notice, which was always hung up, and it was hung below a dead dog, a cat or a chicken. Now I'm going to read you one notice, which I personally copied down and can vouch for. They varied, of course, but this is typical. This notice read, "All those people who are of this land, who sell us to the government, the oath of the dog, cat and chicken will kill them. The stranger to this land of ours who drink our water will die of this oath. All those people who arrest a black man, or all those who try to stop us selling our goods where and when we want, will die of this oath. All those people who work against the activities of the Mau Mau will die of this oath." I want to say, just stop there to say that despite the claim that Mau Mau did not exist, that was in the notice which I translated.
Could I ask one question here about that reference to people stopping them buying and selling as they wanted? What was the meaning of that?
I think one can only loosely say stop us doing our own thing, because there's nothing to stop them buying and selling. I mean, the markets are all over the place, and the Kikuyu were their own traders. Asians were not allowed to trade within the Kikuyu districts. They had freedom of trade. So it's a bit hard to understand. I think it's a stopping us doing what we want to do would be probably another translation. And it went on to say, this oath is important, for the target of it is a woman. And by this, I think it meant that a woman would be used in future oaths instead of the usual dog, chicken and cat. The oath will kill all government servants. This is our aim. Wait and listen. You will understand. We will abide our time. All those who want our help will find us on the mountain of Kenya, the children of Kikuyu and Mumbi. We're back, you see, to this deep custom. The very first oaths were relatively unobjectionable, and there's nothing bestial or abhorrent about them, but it became obvious that not all of the Kikuyu were willing to take these oaths. They didn't want to be forced. They didn't want to bend the knee. And so the KCA, I'm going to change that now to the Mau Mau organisers, because the name Mau Mau is coming in. The Mau Mau organisers devised new initiation ceremonies, tougher ones. And Kenyatta publicly declared that those who did not follow, I'm quoting here, what he called the people's desire would no longer rank as children of the House of Kikuyu and Mumbi, and would forever be despised as people who have never taken part in the initiation of their tribe. We didn't hear the words Mau Mau. They didn't come to public use until about early 1948. Kenyatta said several times he'd never heard the words, he didn't know what they meant. But he did. I'm sure we all knew he did. And he just refuted them, just to confuse government, I think.
What did the words Mau Mau mean?
Don't mean anything. They have no meaning at all. Various people tried to pin meanings on them. The words were taken up by the media in England, and they just got into common usage. But they were used, and they were used by the Kikuyu. They were invented words, and I think they were code words, really. As they had no meaning, they couldn't be found in any Kikuyu dictionary. They were meaningless to Europeans. It was a code name for our society. I wouldn't go further than that. And these oaths went on and went on until early 1952, by which time it had become very clear that about 10% of the Kikuyu did not want to be oathed, really did not. Now, they were going to fight against it. There are various reasons for this. There are a certain type of people who won't be forced into anything. You can't push them around. And others who generally felt that what was going on was not in accordance with true custom. I mentioned earlier that it was a weakness of the oaths that they were administered at night, because according to Kikuyu custom, oaths should be administered by day. So some felt they weren't really binding. But at this time, they introduced new oaths, a new ceremony, and again, there were new clauses to it. Now, I'll read these out. They're from old notes of mine. If I'm sent to bring in the head of an enemy or a European, and if I fail to do so, may this oath kill me. If I fail to steal anything from a European, may this oath kill me. If I know of any enemy to our organisation and fail to tell my leader, may this oath kill me. And if I'm ever sent by my leader to do something big for the House of Kikuyu and Mumbi and refuse to do it, may this oath kill me. And if I refuse to help in driving the Europeans from this land, here they're not talking about Kenya colony as a whole, but Kikuyu land, may this oath kill me. And this is significant. The last clause of that oath was, if I worship any leader but Jomo Kenyatta, may this oath kill me. Now, anyone who did refuse to take that oath was subjected to savage physical violence, often death. And they would be killed in the front of others attending the ceremony, so that it would be seen that the threats were not just empty words. Now, many did bravely refuse, and were killed. We never found out how many, or we never ran into thousands. And the chiefs were forever reporting bodies being discovered and signs of oathing ceremonies, burnt out huts, slaughtered animals and so on. And I personally remember several nastinesses. On one occasion, I was called from my safari tent one morning at dawn and taken to an African Anglican church where a disemboweled goat was splayed out across the altar and the local lay preacher's body, minus head, was spread out before it. On another, I saw two young pregnant women of the same family who lay disemboweled with their fetus stuck in their mouths. And time again, we came upon and were taken to see slashed bodies and so on. Now, with the introduction of this killing oath, lots of the new bestial practices played an increasing part in them. They drank the menstrual blood of women, sucked the juice in the eyes of dead persons and so on. I won't go into those. Let it just be said they became increasingly bestial. The worse they became, the more the opposition to these oaths built up amongst this 10%, who, as far as we were concerned, began to be labelled loyalists. A convenient tag, loyalist. What is a loyalist? In this case, my interpretation of the word loyalist is those who would not go, would not climb on the Mau Mau bandwagon and stood out against it, which does not necessarily mean that they're pro the colonial government. They just didn't want to be pushed around. They didn't like what was going on. And I think it was on the mid-1952, things really were getting very, very bad. There were lots of killings, lots of murders. Every night we were getting reports of these meetings, and when we were out on safari we could often see fires burning on hillsides, and our government staff were becoming increasingly frightened. Well, all these things were reported to Nairobi, but somehow it seems to me they didn't get across. Perhaps it's a little too convenient to say that government in Nairobi didn't want to know. It's very hard to look back and describe a government which was dominated by white settlers, where every elected member in the legislature was either white or a few Asians, but which yet there was not an African elected member. In fact, I may be wrong on this, but I think at the outbreak of emergency we still only had one African member of the legislature, and that was Eliud Mathew, who was nominated by the governor to represent African interests. So you had a legislature responsible for the provision of finance and everything else, which wasn't in tune with the administration in the field. Anyway, I suppose, really, I referred earlier to the outgoing Sir Philip Mitchell, the governor. I said he was a jolly good chap. You see, I think what London really required in those days was that colonial governments should cause no problems. It should keep quiet. It should cost as little as possible. And as long as that happened, all was well. London didn't want to know about things getting difficult. And so it may be, from my simple viewpoint, that I do Mitchell a disservice. It could well be, and I'm in no position to know of dispatches to London at that time, that he was saying the right things but wasn't getting them across. Anyway, he went, and eventually Sir Evelyn Baring came. And in the interregnum between Mitchell, who left, I think, in June 52, and Baring came in September 52. Late September 52, things really did go from bad to worse in the Kikuyu areas. A lot of blood was flowing. Anyway, when Baring came, he obviously came from London with a new brief, and just after his arrival, 59 Kikuyu including Senior Chief Warujio, not of our district, this is the next door district, Kiambu. He was a man of great, a sage man of great influence, were murdered. And also, the first killings of Europeans took place in the settled areas. Now, I don't ever think that Mau Mau started out to kill Europeans. My view is they were often Europeans who got in the way, or more particularly were careless about arms and ammunition which they kept in their houses and which Mau Mau went for. And most settlers would never admit that their Kikuyu staff had been oathed or taken the oath. Time and time again I heard, I know my Kikuyu, I know my staff, I've had Mwangi with me for 47 years and all his children been brought up on my farm. They would never do it. And they did do it, of course. Anyway, on 20th of October 52, the new governor, Susan Baring, signed a proclamation which brought about the state of emergency. It's a very grave step indeed. And Jomo Kenyatta was one of the first to be detained, and he was flown off to a remote part of the colony up in the northern frontier province at a place called Lokitong. As far as we were concerned, a couple of days before the signing, we were called together by the district commissioner, who was then Francis Lloyd, and he told us what was to take place. And as far as Fort Hall was concerned, the district was to be divided in four parts based on existing administrative divisions, with a district officer in residence and in charge of each. And I was to take over the southernmost Kandara division.
What was Lloyd's demeanour when he called you for this meeting? Was it grave?
Oh, very. Very serious and experienced and calm man. Lloyd was never a man who panicked, who reached decisions lightly, a man for whom I had the greatest respect. Oh, very serious indeed. Very serious. We knew that we were going to have a bad time. We didn't realise how bad it was going to be. We still didn't know enough. We thought we knew a lot, but we didn't. We had a lot to learn. I had to give up all thoughts of any welfare committee development aspect of my job, naturally. And I was sent into Kandara Division on the evening of the declaration of, within 10 minutes of the declaration of the emergency. Remember, we'd had our meeting with Lloyd 2 days before. 10 tribal policemen, 4 small contingents of Kenya police, that was one for each location. There were 5 Kenya policemen and a sergeant or corporal in each of those contingents. And 1 company of the King's African Rifles, the Uganda Battalion. And we all just swept into the area. The locals were surprised to see this, perhaps a bit alarmed. I don't know if they were terribly at first. What the locals did not know, that we had no clue as to what we were going to do with this force. We obviously wanted to have a show of strength to show them that the government meant business, and this really was the object of having the troops there. What were the troops going to do? I think probably the best analogy is to look at the Americans in Vietnam. The Americans poured in hundreds of thousands of troops, but how does a single American white soldier, let us say who's been brought up in New York, go out into Vietnam and by looking at a Vietnamese person say that person is a Kong or not a Kong? Well, how did our troops? And you have to remember that the King's African Rifles, and I mentioned the Uganda Battalion, their faces were black, but they were just as different in makeup from the Kikuyu as I was, in a way. Different languages, different backgrounds. They were strangers too. And just because we were faced with 80-odd thousand, I suppose, was my population share of the district, people of whom we knew that 90% had taken an oath and were Mau Mau, didn't really allow us to point the finger at any of them. We had a lot of learning to do. I well remember that first day, that first night, actually, because there was a local village hall in which we camped. My tribal police orderly put up my tent, and I had a tent. And I think the army put up a few tents for themselves, but the main work was the next morning. And it was decided I had to have an office. And the army had very kindly supplied a marquee for me, which to put stores and have an office for the time being, temporary one. And I remember that the sergeant, the army sergeant, in charge of putting up the marquee was one Idi Amin, who made an awful job of putting it up. He tried to put it up upside down.
What kind of impression did you get of him?
Well, I suppose I had the same impression that the army had of him, a jolly, big, physical, rather handsome specimen, extrovert, jolly nice chap, well known as the army boxing champion. Yeah, jolly nice chap sums him up. But I'll just make a brief further mention of him and then I'll drop him altogether. One of the first things we had to do, Kandahar tended to be, I should think Kandahar was probably at its widest 12 miles wide and probably 20 miles long, tip to tip. It might have even been smaller than that, but it wasn't very large. But we had to get patrols out of the army into all this area so that they could be seen, so that we could... I had to zoom round the whole of this area immediately saying, we've slapped on a curfew, this is what a curfew is, this is what it means, this is what you will do. The army are going to patrol, which meant that patrols had to go out. And I must be careful here because memory can be very deceiving where time is concerned, but very, very soon, memory says a couple of weeks after the declaration of this state of emergency, the army shot a Kikuyu who was running away and declared he was a Mau Mau. I can't remember any more than that, I must say, but one thing I do remember was the person in charge of that patrol was Idi Amin. He was so well known in the KR. Now looking back at it, I wonder how innocent that person was. However, Kandahar itself got a school, rather nice brick-built school, good playing field, a few small buildings which made the chief's office and a little agricultural office, a little health office, a dispensary and so on, and a small trading centre, and that was to be my headquarters until May 55. So I spent 2.5 years in Kandahar. For the first 6 months, we didn't know very much, to be frank. We were feeling our way. We'd learnt in some ways how to recognise Mau Mau. The chiefs and headmen were beginning to tell us of bad people or people who'd disappeared. When I say bad people, this is exactly as a chief would refer to them, to a man in Swahili, mtumbaya, a bad man. Bad sort of all-embracing. One thing Mau Mau decided to do was not look at Europeans. So every time I drove around or walked around, if people cast their eyes to the ground, I could be pretty sure they'd taken the oath. And believe me, if you're in a group, if you're amongst a lot of people, all of whom cast their eyes to the ground, it's pretty unsettling and very unpleasant. It goes on all the time. And then they wouldn't speak to us unless spoken to. And hitherto everyone had greeted us, either in Swahili, Jambo Wana, Jambo, or in Kikuyu, you know, Nikwaga, Nikwaga Madongo, greetings European, whatever it was. All this disappeared. And then